The legionary dashed through a sudden flurry of Imperial Fist's bolts as he broke from the cover of a half-dismantled cargo loader that looked like a giant dissected beetle.
"Only days ago you lamented that the Iron Warriors risked failure by their inability to seize the bridgeways. Now you spend your warriors clearing out maintenance sheds and transit terminals."
Checking the schematics, the first captain saw that there was only one way to advance without being exposed: directly through the Imperial Fist's line. Whoever commanded the local forces had chosen the workshops as a choke point, easily supported from the internal ringway. If the Sons of Horus could break through, they would turn the flank of a 5-kilometer-long defence line, protecting the upper approaches of the sky bridges.
"When it comes time to seize your prize, you cannot hesitate,"
Laerc continued, oblivious to Abaddon's apathy.
"I've had a change of heart," Abaddon told him.
His auto-senses picked up the rumble of the tanks.
"A longer view."
He rounded the end of the auto-lathe, sighting along his combi bolter. Spying the flash of yellow behind a pile of gears and other spare parts, he opened fire. The volleys sparked from the heap, filling the air with a cloud of shrapnel. Taking his lead, two squads of Justerin poured fire into the same position, incendiary rounds mixed in with the regular bolts to set the metal pile ablaze.
"Perturabo wants to seize the spaceport to bring in Titans for Horus," Abaddon explained, as he advanced behind the curtain of fire, his own weapon adding half a dozen more rounds to the fusillade. "It has not fallen quickly enough, so it is better to use this battle to draw in as many defenders as possible. Every Imperial Fist that dies here is one less to defend the wall."
Laerc appeared at his side, black energy leaping from his staff. The sorcerous lightning engulfed an enemy squad pulling back from the Terminator attack, leaping from one space marine to the next. They crashed to the ground in turn, bloody vapour coiling from shattered eye lenses and ruptured armour joints.
"Time is our enemy. You know this."
The word-bearer thrust his staff forward, and his blade slaves stormed ahead, the detonations of enemy bolts across their half-armour skin no dissuasion. Vaulting the next line of workbenches, they set upon the Imperial Fists beyond. Abaddon ran after them, exploiting the gap in the enemy fire created by the sudden assault.
"The threat of Gilliman may be overrated,"
he growled back.
"The arrival of Gilliman, the Lion, and Russ is not the only factor,"
Laerc warned.
"You have seen the toll paid by your master to channel the energy of the True Gods. Every day he must contain their power is a day closer to his ruin."
Abaddon smashed a bench out of the way with his power fist, flipping it into the armoured warriors beyond. He followed up with a burst of fire that cut down two Sons of Dawn. The roar of vehicle engines shook the workshop, flakes of rust falling on both sides from the high rafters. Abaddon's focus was on the foes to his left and right, as he clamped his bolter to his armour and drew his blade, parrying the chainsword of an Imperial Fist's sergeant. His fist closed about the legionary's arm, crushing armour, flesh and bone to a pulp of blood and broken ceramite. The thunder of heavy bolters and autocannons cut across the din of the escalating melee, followed by the crack of breaking warplate. The Vox was strangely silent for a few seconds. Abaddon turned aside a boarding axe with his glove and cleaved his blade into the bearer, parting his foes for a glimpse at the armoured squadron pulling up beyond the main gateway. He saw dark metal armour broken by stripes of red and black, their hulls festooned with scrawled dedications to Perturabo and Horus. Skulls and pieces of armour hung like bunting from exhaust stacks and weapon pintles. Iron warriors. From a pair of land raiders emerged two squads of ironclad legionaries, just as the transports and their escort of predators opened fire again. Lascannon blasts and explosive shells raked into the surrounded Imperial Fists, tearing apart warplate and gen-hanced bodies.
"Hold position!"
Abaddon bellowed to his warriors, concerned that they would charge forward into the fire of their allies.
"Mark your targets!"
Bolters adding to the fury of the attack, the Iron Warriors advanced, more squads arriving behind them in a wave of rhinos. In their midst strode an officer with old-style cataphracty plate, armour coated with bloody handprints as grisly livery.
"Warsmith Kroger," said Laerc, "come to welcome the right and left hands of Horus."
A knot of several dozen Imperial Fists tried to break out, turning from the newly arrived legionaries to seek escape through the Sons of Horus. Abaddon dispatched his Justerin with a word and gesture. His focus turned to the Iron Warrior's commander. Kroger used a crackling fist in great sweeps, breaking open helms and plastrons without any thought of defence. He advanced without pause, treading over the slain of both sides, rivet-studded boots cracking ceramite beneath his weight. Abaddon sheathed his blade and took up his bolter once more, turning to fire the rest of the loaded magazine into the withdrawing Imperial fists. He passed the weapon to one of his companions to reload as he came face to face with Kroger. The Iron Warrior's shoulders heaved as though he were panting, something primal in his hunched stance. His blood-specked mask looked up at Abaddon, eyes hidden behind red lenses.
"Captain Abaddon,"
Kroger grunted, raising his fist in salute.
"Warsmith Kroger."
Abaddon touched a finger to his brow in return.
"I was not expecting you." "Been looking for you. Came on a Dawn Scum flying column and wondered where they were going. Saw there was a fight going on where one of my companies were, so I took them out on the way and came here to see what the fuss was."
Kroger took a shuddering breath.
"Here you are. Haven't heard from your Legion Command since you captured the Upper Sensoria."
"I am the Sons of Horus Command," Abaddon said pointedly. "I choose our objectives and the manner in which we will achieve them."
"I'm not here to tell you otherwise," said Kroger. "You're Ezekiel Abaddon, one of our greatest commanders. But if you find yourself wanting something to do, I think we can stop this counterattack within the day."
"How do you plan to do that?" asked Abaddon.
"An unstoppable force, Captain Abaddon. My Dodecathic Guard will take the brunt of the fighting. Hardened warriors, unshakable. Dreadnoughts, automatons, mobile support weapons. Khan and his blooded are joining me."
"A keen blade edge to cut through the morass," said Leak,
tone betraying his relish at the idea.
"You must be the Crimson Apostle, the War Master's demon caller."
Abaddon felt a stab of amusement at the petty title, but Leak bridled.
"I am the spiritual aid of Horus Lupercal, prophet of the dark gods, lord of mysteries."
"Have you broken the Emperor's psychic shield yet?"
"The process is ongoing. One does not pierce—"
"Thought not,"
said Kroger, turning back to Abaddon. Horus's lieutenant was drawn to the warsmith's brusqueness, so at odds with the theatrics of Leak.
"I thought you were trying to link up with the force inside Sky City,"
Abaddon said, noting that the Blade Slaves had closed in on Leak, perhaps in an attempt to intimidate Kroger.
"What of the warsmith trapped behind the lines?"
"Plans change,"
Kroger said with a shrug.
"I've not heard from Forex in days. Probably dead."
"You would abandon one of the Trident," said Leak. "One dispatched by your own orders."
"Don't think Forex would spare a second thought for me, Warp Talker. He had a fighting chance, which is more than he'd give to those he wanted rid of."
Kroger swung his gaze to Abaddon.
"Think about it. You. Me. Khan of the World Eaters. Just let them try and stop us."
Abaddon was thinking about it very carefully. In a war of gods and demigods, here was a chance for the legions to prove their strength was undiminished. Even as his gene father drew ever greater strength from his immaterial patrons, it would be wise to remind him of the mortal power still at his command. There was still much that could be done with a bolter and a blade, and a legionary behind them. Lionsgate Spaceport, Stratifex Corps, 12 days since assault.
"Phosphix!"
The call echoed down the passage and across the Vox, just seconds before a junction 30 meters ahead of Forex brightened with yellow light. He thought his engineered body was already pushed to the limits, but that single word set his hearts racing, his armor pumping the last drops of stimulant into his body. The squads nearest the attack had no chance. The air around them ignited, a cloud of fire crawling through nothing to engulf their armored forms. Their shrieks, noises that no legionaries should ever produce, were thankfully brief. The silhouettes of diminishing figures danced in afterimage as Forex tried to blink away the glare of the Phosphex, having been forced to discard his damaged helm the day before. Even at this distance, he felt the prickle of impossible heat in the first moments and was turning to run even as he bellowed the order to pull back. Space Marines did not panic, but the retreat from the living flames was hurried and disorderly. Snaking tendrils of fire raced along the high ceiling, overtaking the slowest runners, droplets raining down on their helms and pauldrons. The phosphex made fuel of whatever it landed on, and it devoured with all the rapaciousness of a starved glutton. A fully armoured legionary was reduced to ashes in less than 7 seconds, and once they started burning, there was nothing that would stop it.
"Dodge, bastards!"
swore Uhaz.
"Burning their own city!"
It was a terrible but effective tactic, and Forex was grudgingly impressed that the commanders of the 7th Legion had the stomach for such a move. Unless, and he voiced this thought to nobody, the phosphex had come from the Iron Warrior's own bombardment. It was possible that some of the barrage unleashed on the first day was still creeping around the spaceport like a burning mass murderer, looking for fresh victims, even 14 days later. Three more legionaries thrashed their last as the phosphex speared after them, creeping up from their boots to swallow them legs first, the rounds in their bolters snapping as they detonated, spraying flecks of metal that turned to mist in the heat of the flames. 11 days. Forex reached a stairwell and turned into it, throwing himself up the steps with the others. Distance was the only saviour. 11 days since they had mustered, expecting reinforcements after 2 days. They had certainly tested the defenders. The Imperial Fists had stopped sending their allies after 8 days, perhaps balking at the immense casualties inflicted by the warriors of the 4th Legion. It was the ideal fight, in a way, for an Iron Warrior. Fighting stubbornly for its own merits, no broader strategy, no vague objectives or collateral concerns. Engage, kill, survive. Forex continued past the next landing, seeing through a set of open doors that the level above was already flickering with eerie phosphex light.
"Regroup at 75 meters up,"
he voxed to all in range. He transmitted to the command channel as he ran, gulping down breaths that tasted of his brother's charred flesh and molten armour. Glancing down the stairwell, he saw the phosphex creeping towards the steps.
"Corral! What is your position relative to the eastern stairwell in designated Sector 6?
There was no reply. He tried again, wondering if it was his vox malfunctioning or a problem with Garal's reception.
"Engaged by dreadnoughts and heavy-gauge power armour. Cataphracti and other squads. There is phosphex creep from level 80 through 83. Understood. Has it reached the maintenance bays we moved through last night?
I don't think so. Seems to be moving vertically more than horizontally, burning down through the plasteel decking around here.
I'll lead the heavy infantry towards it, then. Let's see Dawn's filth run away from the stuff for a change."
Garal chuckled and the link cut off. Forex reached the summit of the spiralling stair and slumped against the wall. Every muscle burned with fatigue, even with the assistance of his warplate. He waited while scores of Iron Warriors hurried past, most of them sporting broken and patched armour, wearing elements of yellow stolen from their foes, burned and scarred and riddled with craters from bolter impacts. Others bore heavier injuries, missing hands and arms, their skulls exposed or cheeks pierced by shot. Those without helms met his gaze, and all he saw in them was determination. This was the iron in their blood, the metal of the spirit. The retreat slowed to a steadier pace, becoming a march. A chant started, the words issuing to the beat of armoured footfalls.
"From iron cometh strength, from strength cometh will, from will cometh faith, from faith cometh honour, from honour cometh iron."
Never had Forex seen his warriors so undaunted and formidable. The longer they were hammered upon the anvil of battle, the harder they became. But it would not be enough. Forex had been keeping track of their losses and movements, and they were being hemmed in, corralled by the Imperial Fists, contained. That was not the act of a foe worrying about assault from further afield. Something disastrous must have happened to the main assault, leaving Forex's force the only functioning Iron Warrior's formation, and he was running out of room to fight. Once they were cornered, it was over. It was a testament to their character that they had lasted this long, but they could not prevail indefinitely. Perhaps 2 more days at most. That's all they had left. He needed a better plan. Himalaya, 30 days before assault. They heard engines long before they saw the tanks. The rumble of scores of vehicles reverberated along the valley, following the course of the road as it wound towards the highest peaks.
Off the road! Off the road!
The bellow echoed from officers and integrity officers, sergeants and troopers alike. With the rest of the platoon, Zenobi broke left, up the slope of the mountain. There was little enough cover, boulders and outcrops. There were no trees, but thousands of knee-high stumps, every square centimetre of forest having been stripped for materials to bolster the Imperial Palace. They hunkered down as best they could, plumes of white following them as they waded through the snow. The growling grew louder and louder, until it rivaled the dull, constant noise of the production line. Gears clanked, metal creaked, adding mechanical voices to the continual background wail of the Himalayan winds. Lying down in the snow made little difference to Zenobi. She had long since lost any real feeling in her legs. Her feet were a constant aching throb inside her boots, and her hands, even inside three gloves, barely flexed. She stripped off the gloves to use her fingertips to clear ice from the trigger guard of her lasgun. She pushed the arming stud, but nothing happened. No vibration of the energy cell activating. No indicator lights turning from red to amber to green.
"Power cells are frozen," she whispered,
turning her head to Sergeant Attar on her left. In reply, the sergeant pulled out her own lasgun and repeatedly breathed on the main body of it. After a minute or so of this, a flickering light lit the sergeant's face from below. Zenobi nodded and copied Attar, holding the lasgun close to her mouth to maximize the body heat that reached it. She tested the activation stud each time, and after the fourth misty exhalation, the lights glimmered into jade life. Whether it would be enough to hold a charge after a shot was another matter.
"Not that they'll be much good against tanks," muttered Ketai.
Squad structure had been abandoned on the march. Everyone moved at their own pace as best they could. Several dozen more troopers had been lost in the time since they'd come across the frozen battle. 6 days, 7 days, more. She shifted, a root digging at her thigh. The sound of engines changed, growing louder but also more diffused, as the source came closer. Rather than reverberating down the valley as a single noise, she thought she could pick up individual vehicles and the rumble of tracks on the road. It sounded familiar. Bulky shapes loomed through the flurries of snow, and the wind brought the distinctive tang of fuel exhaust. The steady clank, clank, clank grew louder still as they approached. The snarl of gears and squeal of a turret rotating on its ring punctuated the noise. There were dozens, perhaps scores of tanks driving slowly up the road, the back of the column lost in the distance and snow. Accounting for the fact that they were in the open air, rather than a cavernous testing chamber, the sound took her back to the time she'd crept into the arming hangar at the end of the line, where the fully assembled tanks were driven from the production facility. She wasn't the only one that thought so. There were exclamations around her.
"These are our tanks," said Member.
Green pennants flew from whip aerials, bent forward by the prevailing wind. Every few tanks there was one that bore the flag of a squadron commander. These were large, square standards, decorated with the laurels of the Imperial Army, encircling two crossing curved blades.
"I know that flag," said Ketai,
rising to his knees.
"That's from Bakmaka, one of the cities we sent our tanks."
All along the line, troopers and officers were breaking from the banks of snow, their shouts almost lost in the cacophony of engines. They waved their hands to attract the attention of the crews. Someone in command must have seen them. One by one, the tanks ground to a halt, turrets and sponson guns bearing on the approaching infantry. Member helped Zenobi up as she cradled her lasgun under her arm and pulled the standard pole from a white drift. Flanked by her cousin and Ketai, she waded back towards the road, using the banner like a staff to negotiate the parts that came almost to her waist. There was a tank almost directly opposite their position, a gap of 10 meters between it and its neighbours. A heavy bolter in the closest sponson was trained on them, as was the massive battle cannon in the turret. Steam billowed from the engine vents, and grey slicked the blizzard from the exhaust stacks at the rear. Melting ice left streaks on the dirty hull, revealing a grey camouflage scheme that made Zenobi laugh.
"I might have painted that," she said,
her main labour having been with the spray brush just before the end of the line. Her family were, had been, she reminded herself, fitters and finishers by trade. The hatch atop the turret creaked open, and a young man, no more than 20 or 21, Zenobi thought, rose cautiously from within. He had a las pistol in hand, his face hidden behind broad goggles over a tanker's cap. His mouth and nose were swathed in a scarf woven of bright red, emerald green, and dark blue. What she could see of his skin was lighter than her own, though it might have also been caked in grime. He pulled up the goggles, squinting against the wind.
"Stay where you are! Do not approach!"
The voxmeter of the tank didn't mask his clipped accent. He raised the las pistol as if the threat of the battle cannon and heavy bolter were not enough.
"We're from Adaba,"
Ketai called out.
"We made your tanks. Keep back,"
the commander warned. They did as he said, stopping about 20 meters from the low wall that ran along the roadside.
"We will open fire if you come closer."
The message was the same all along the column, so that the Adaba Free Corps formed a near continuous line, 3 and 4 deep. Platoon commanders wearily told their subordinates to remain in place, and assured them that General Captain Egwu was communicating with the leader of the armoured regiment.
"You from Bakmaka?"
Member called out.
"How long have you been driving?" 14 days, including resupply stops,"
the commander called back over the voxmeter.
"Where did you say you come from?" "Adaba,"
Member told him. The commander stiffened with surprise.
"You've walked 5,000 kilometers.
There were laughs from the Free Corps troopers.
"It feels like it, but no,"
Member explained.
"We had a train, but it was attacked. Been walking the last 500 kilometers or so. Do you know how far we've got left?"
The tank commander leaned forward, resting his arm on the turret roof, holding the las pistol more casually now.
"About another 300 kilometers until we reach the Katabatic Plains."
He pointed eastwards, towards the roiling aurora of the continuing attack.
"The road goes pretty much straight from here, but that's at least another 15 days on foot in these conditions."
"And more,"
said Member.
"Everyone's exhausted."
"Any chance of a ride?"
Ketai called out.
"That's what I'm waiting to hear from General Mushazipti. I'd say yes, but it's not up to me."
They fell silent as they awaited the verdict of the consultation between their commanders. A figure approached along the line, one arm in a sling. It was Tesfaye, the integrity officer assigned to the platoon, the one that Zenobi had stopped Tewedros murdering. Okoye and a few of the sergeants gravitated towards him, seeking news. The integrity officer continued along the line, looking at the troopers. He pitched his voice to be heard above the wind, but not so much that it would carry over the idling engines of the tanks. He repeated himself every dozen steps, speaking to the troopers in clusters.
"Remember to keep your tongues still,"
said Tesfaye as he came upon Zenobi and the others nearby.
"Any one of these back Makahi might relate anything we say to those that would see us thwarted. They are temporary allies at best. Do not become overly familiar."
Tesfaye carried on, his words lost in the snowstorm, and soon so was he.
"I guess that means we'll be getting a ride,"
said Ketai. His guess was proven correct a few minutes later. Shouts moved along the line from the front, but before they reached the survivors of Epsilon Platoon, the tank commander was on the voxmeter.
"Good news, my new friends! Climb aboard!"
One of the gunner hatches opened, and a crewman exited, guiding them to where they could safely sit on the track skirts, avoiding the hot engine grill and exhausts. Most of them were used to scrambling over the giant beasts of metal, and probably knew their way around better than those within, finding handholds and spaces amongst the baggage and spare track links already strapped along the flanks.
"If we come under attack, you get off instantly,"
the commander continued as they pulled themselves and their gear up the tank's sides.
"You don't want to be aboard when we get into battle."
Zenobi found herself helped up to the turret itself. She saw the commander looking at her with dark brown eyes, and wondered what he made of the dishevelled, coat-swathed shape in front of him. His appraising gaze made her smile, appreciation in the eyes as he lingered on her rhymed face.
"Why are you looking at me like that?"
she asked. He pulled down the scarf to reveal thin lips smiling beneath a generous moustache. Zenobi found the shape of them appealing, as she did the broad cheekbones and the rest of his features. Very appealing.
"I like what I see," said the commander.
He held out a hand, and she clumsily shook it.
"I am Nasha, and this,"
he thumped a hand on the armoured turret, "is Breath of Wrath."
"Nice,"
said Zenobi, stroking a hand along the welded plate.
"I hope you're taking care of her."
"Her?"
"Everything we make in Adaba is a girl,"
said Zenobi. She grinned, having not really thought about it before.
"We find they have a better temperament that way."
"And you are?"
"Zenobi. Zenobi Adedeji."
Their eyes met, and she felt the frisson of attraction again. It seemed ridiculous to be flirting with this man she had just met in the middle of a blizzard on the way to her first and last battle. She couldn't help it. The chemistry was immediate, the feeling mutual.
"You're a small one, Zenobi Adedeji."
He leaned back in the turret hatch.
"I reckon I might be able to squeeze you in here, if you're willing,
and allowed, of course." Zenobi moved closer, and he pulled himself out fully, offering her his hands to help her, strong around her waist. She half heard Member saying something behind her, and Ketai laughing. It didn't matter. To get away from the snow and the cold and the wind for a few minutes, Zenobi would have accepted, even had Nasha been a toothless, ugly brute of a man. It was just a bonus that he wasn't. Chapter 24. Call for a Champion. Complications. Plague of Belief. Exultant Wall Zone, 12 days since assault. Keela watched the custodians and regent move away before she turned back to Dawn and Sigismund. She could feel the antipathy of the Primarch like a physical force, as though waves of heat emanated from the immense warrior. He turned a belligerent stare down to her, a lip curled.
"We have nothing further to discuss."
Keela struggled to find her voice in the face of the Primarch's disdain. Swallowing hard, she remembered she was doing the Emperor's work, and forced herself to look up at the glowering demigod.
"I would like to speak with Captain Sigismund."
Dawn stepped closer, just half a pace, but in that small movement he changed from bulky to menacingly oppressive. Like a moon being eclipsed by its planet, Keela's world shrank to the couple of meters between them, as though nothing else existed. Her hand moved to the book concealed in her breast pocket.
"Your lies have done enough damage. There will be no more."
She trembled as she met his iron gaze, knowing that those eyes had looked upon the deaths of thousands, millions even, and shown not the slightest compassion. It was as if Dawn were made of the same unfeeling stone as the fortifications he built.
"I have not lied. Is it not true that had he travelled to Fal, Sigismund would now be among the thousands of dead?"
"He is no better than those that gave their lives. Now he thinks himself special, weakened by your delusion. He took the coward's choice."
Keela stepped back, giving herself space to breathe. She felt the reassuring presence of Cinderman at her shoulder, his hand lightly touching her arm. Past Dawn, she saw the first captain a few meters away, head turned towards them. She addressed her next words to him directly.
"The Emperor has need of you, Sigismund."
"No more!"
Dawn clenched his fists. Keela drew back with a gasp, though she did not think he would swing them with lethal intent. His shoulders flexed within his bulky armor, servos whining as he sought to control his temper.
"Is it not enough that you robbed me of one of my finest sons? Do not turn him further from his duty."
"He's not your son. He's the Empress,"
snarled Keela. She recoiled, shocked by her own vehemence. Her voice lowered, and she looked at the warrior in yellow and black.
"The great enemies we face choose their champions, and pour all of their spite and power into them. Horus is at the pinnacle, a vessel for all the hurt and tragedy and wrath that the warp-twisted body can hold."
Her eyes moved back to Dawn.
"Your brothers, I hear they have become something else, have they not? The perverted gifts of their gods give them abilities beyond even those that the Emperor bestowed upon you.
You have not the strength to face them without accepting the power of the Emperor into your soul.
Soul? Keep your nonsense to yourself.
Then what is it that stays their advance? A psychic shield? Or the soul of the Emperor, bright and hot to them, as the Astronomican is to the navigators?
She made one more entreaty to Sigismund.
Who will face those champions of the Dark Powers? The Emperor needs his own, and through me he has guided your step from disaster to stand here upon these walls to face them.
No more!
Dorn's voice was a growl as he loomed over Keeler. He thrust a finger towards Sigismund, without looking in his direction.
Go to the gatekeep now, Captain.
Sigismund remained a moment, silently watching Keeler, before he turned and continued down the corridor.
It is only the mantle of Malkador that keeps you from your deserved cell, Keeler, Dorn told her, bending low so that they were almost eye to eye. Report to him. Work with the custodians. If I learn that you have spoken to any of my warriors again, Malkador's protection will not keep you safe, and it would not be imprisonment that silences you.
He straightened and composed himself for several seconds, eyes closed. When he opened them, he looked at Sindarin, silently appraising the old man. The Primarch said nothing of his conclusions, but pivoted on his heel and marched after Sigismund. Keeler stood shaking, Sindarin's hand on her arm. Taking a deep breath, she stood upright, drawing her hand away from the book within her dress. Sigismund's ascension to the truth was but one of the tasks she had been set by the Emperor. The matter with the Lightbearers required her full focus. Lionsgate Spaceport, Mesifex Approach, 14 days since assault. How many times had Sigismund sat like this in a drop pod or gunship or boarding torpedo, hurtling towards battle, sat in quiet repose? His Templars knew him well and did not interrupt his silence, save for the periodic countdown to their landing. 3 minutes. It was therefore strange for Sigismund when the pilot, Kassar, contacted him on the command Vox channel.
First Captain, apologies for the interruption, but there has been a development.
What sort of development?
Augur scans show a notable hole in the Iron Warriors' deployment. A landing apron behind their advance appears unprotected.
A trap?
Unlikely, First Captain. Energy signature suggests that a force landed there in drop pods, but rather than securing the site, they have pressed onwards in totality, leaving no rearguard.
Where?
Fourth Eastward Key Spur, First Captain. Large enough for the whole force to land.
Agreed. Send word to the rest of the expedition. Redirect attack to the Fourth Eastward Key Spur.
Affirmative.
Sigismund felt the craft bank as it adjusted course, so that it would come around the spaceport and approach from the opposite direction. The captain of the Templars tried to regain his focus, drawing into himself once more. He brought his hands together, remembering the conversation with Lord Dorn and Euphrates Keeler. He had not thought to see her again, and her presence was a source of some turbulence in his mind. He could not afford to be distracted. The Iron Warriors and World Eaters would break through Rand's defensive line within hours. It vexed Sigismund that he did not know whether Dorn had dispatched him because of the urgency of the situation, or because he had finally wanted to be rid of the First Captain. Had he been sent to Lionsgate Spaceport to die? 90 seconds. The Stormbird slowed. Gunners opened fire as defensive batteries overrun by the traitors targeted the incoming assault force. Flak shells exploded around the descending gunships, shrapnel rattling against the armored hull. Sigismund drove the sound away. This was his chance to prove himself. If he delivered the spaceport from the enemy, it was proof that he had been right to return to Terra, rather than join the ill-fated expedition to Fal. This was the battle for which he had been directed. Keeler herself had said as much. Had Lord Dorn been convinced by her words? He had departed in anger, but perhaps cooler, wiser counsel could yet prevail. 10 seconds. Sigismund stood up, checking the chains that kept his sword locked to his armor. Bound by metal, bound by oath, bound by fate to his blade. The Stormbird dropped almost vertically, plasma jets roaring, assault ramps slammed down, and Sigismund was first to the ferrocrete, eyes scanning the abandoned landing key. Nothing but empty drop pods. Not a trap. It did not matter. There would be plenty of enemies to face. Himalaya, 30 days before assault. The warmth inside the bivouac was deceptive. Outside, a gale howled and snow piled up against the tank which formed one wall of the tent. Zenobi shifted, feeling the heat from Nasha, cocooned in their shared bedroll. The hab unit she'd lived in with her family had been cramped. The bivouac had been intended for a crew of 5, and now housed an extra 15 troopers. She and Nasha had found intimacy in the simple act of closeness. But space, and an opportunity for anything more amorous, had so far been denied them. 2 days, he said, stroking fingers across the curls of her hair. His breath on her neck sent shivers through Zenobi.
Only 2 more days. Until the battle?
Not yet. That's when we arrive at our muster point. It's still another 100 kilometers to the Katabatic Plains. She said nothing but listened instead, their companions' heavy breaths and snores. The whine of the tank battery lighting the small lantern hung on the pole that held up the centre of the bivouac, and thunder that wasn't thunder, but the detonations of gigatons of ordnance crashing against the shields of the Imperial Palace. Every few minutes there would come a crack of a different timbre, as some new projectile hit home, or a void shield temporarily failed.
"We might not ever,"
she whispered, stroking the back of her hand along his thigh.
"You know, we might not have time to
be united," he said with a smirk.
"I know. It's not that important." "Maybe not for you,"
she said sadly. "Oh." He pulled her closer.
"We might not be moving from the muster point for a while. I think we'll be carrying straight on."
"Really?
What were your orders?"
Zenobi felt a sudden pang of awareness. She couldn't let down her guard, even for a moment of pillow talk.
"I don't know. But we were all expecting to get straight into the battle."
She listened for a few more seconds.
"The attack's well underway."
"The battle for Terra," he said, eyes comically wide. "Never thought I would be part of it. Never considered that the war would come here."
"It's been here a while," said Zenobi. "The touch of it, I mean. I don't know anything about Bakmakar, but Adaba was first affected 7 years ago.
"Changed, yes," said Nasha. "They flattened the old precincts to make a testing and training range. 300 square kilometers of city from before the old night. Ancient, really ancient buildings." He sighed, and she laid her head on his arm.
"Don't be so sure about what's going to happen," he told her.
"It'll take a day or two for your formation to receive fresh orders from High Command.
You're not even supposed to be here." "I'm glad that we are," she said.
She kissed his neck, and their conversation ended. Basilica Ventura, 13 days since assault.
An impressive gathering.
Sinderman was right. Through a window in the upper reaches of the Basilica Ventura, mostly frame with only a few shards of glass remaining, Keeler could see some distance down the Via Occidentus. There was light everywhere, not just clustered at the gateway below, but stretched out along the approaches to the improvised fane. People brought their own lamps, as well as those that were handed out at the doors, their bobbing progress easy to follow in the evening gloom.
"I hear because of you, Holy One," said Olivier. "A word spreads that the emissary of the Emperor graces the light-bearers with divine blessing."
"Blessing is not mine to deliver," Keeler warned him. "Only the word of the Emperor."
"Of course, but he has sent you to us as a sign of his favor," Olivier said quickly.
He gestured, and his 2 attendants, Maurice and Essenam, came across the small chamber, holding the massive bound copies of the Book of Divinity. Keeler had meant to ask where they had come from, but had not yet had the opportunity.
"It would honor me if you would lay your hands upon our texts."
Keeler did so, putting a palm to the cover of each, feeling the embossed lettering under her fingertips. It was as though she could feel the words inside stretching to be read, eager to leave the page and set themselves free in her thoughts. She pulled her hand back, a tingle of sensation running up her arms.
"Would you address the congregation tonight?" Olivier asked.
Keeler considered it and shook her head.
"Not yet. These are your people. This is your creed. I am the follower here, and would not take that from you."
I simply heard the message that you whispered in our ears, Holy One, Olivier said, clasping his hands together. He looked pointedly at the tomes carried by his companions.
And the words of truth, as laid down in this book, of course.
Do not undersell yourself, said Cinderman, clasping a hand to Olivier's shoulder, gently guiding him towards the door.
The lights hang because of you, and the whisper travels because your voice has been added to it.
Before he realized what was happening, Olivier had been coaxed to the curtained doorway, Essienam and Maurice diligently flanking him.
I will join you shortly, Keeler assured him.
He accepted this with a smile and left. Cinderman took a deep breath and crossed back to her, gaze moving to the scene outside the window. It was not only the light of lamps that broke the twilight. It seemed as though a patch of sky at the horizon were ablaze, but in truth it was the star spear of Lionsgate spaceport, lit with the fires of battle.
The traitors are pushing hard to take the spaceport, said Cinderman. It may be only a matter of hours or days before they're at the Lion's Gate itself.
A victory that would have been far swifter, if not for the protections against the Neverborn, Keeler replied.
There have been more apparitions, lady.
Cinderman rubbed his hands slowly, as though wiping away something in his palms.
I have heard rumours of visitations, and received word from Custodian Amon that he has uncovered two more sites of what he claims to be demonic activity, though the gatherings that caused them had dispersed before his arrival.
The blind guess at what they see, but those that have seen know the truth, Keeler told him. If one expects the infernal, one sees it.
Amon would argue that if one expects the divine, one would also see it.
You would be wrong. I have touched the light of the Emperor. It cannot be feigned.
There have been other stories that tell of warming lights and of soldiers on the walls seeing gold-clad ghosts sallying forth into the murk. A group of staff officers that meets by the Pradeshi Way says that they shared a group dream of the Emperor, in which he came to them and commanded they defend the wall at a certain place. The following day the traitors launched themselves at that section and were barely repelled. Had they followed Dawn's deployment orders, there is a chance the enemy would have gained a foothold.
It is too much for a pragmatist like Rogel Dawn to place his faith in forces he cannot comprehend, said Keeler. Though I feel he is starting to appreciate more their magnitude in opposition with each passing day.
She fell silent, lost in her thoughts. Cinderman withdrew across the chamber, moving to another window. A rumble of jet engines shook the basilica as a flight of bombers flew low over the stretch of the palace, heading towards the outer wall. Keeler took out her Lectitio Divinitatis and opened it to the first page.
Rejoice, for I bring glorious news. God walks among us.
She lost herself in the words, as she had done the first time the scripture had been shown to her. It described with certainty the divinity of the Emperor, rightly placing him among the celestial spheres as a being to be venerated. She knew the opening chapters by heart, but took strength from her own simple handwriting forming the words, as though her voice were given permanent form. It was with some effort that she roused herself on hearing Cinderman speak her name.
The congregation is ready, he told her. Olivier will be waiting.
She reluctantly closed the book and headed down to the broken stairwell that took her to the platform of the chief light-bearer. Without ceremony, she passed through the archway and came up behind him, not willing to place herself before him. He turned and acknowledged her with a simple nod, and then began his sermon. She did not listen to his words so much as the cadence of his voice. As before, she let the flowing shadow pictures take shape in her thoughts, growing branches and leaves from flickering light, while the voice of Olivier took on the role of the gusting breeze once more. And even more simply than the first time, she slipped into the garden. She was more intent on her purpose than previously, and she barely spared a thought for the glorious flora that surrounded her. Greater than ever were the blooms that clustered close, petals and stems turning towards her as though drawn by her life, seeking her energy rather than that of the sun. Keeler stepped quickly through the waving grass, ignoring the tickles at her legs, as seed-heavy heads brushed at knee and calf, caressing her as though trying to entice her to remain. She was dimly aware of others now, her fellow worshippers each picking their own path through the cultured wilderness.
Like the shadows of cloud wisps far above, they drifted past, almost unseen, heading to their own destinations. Keela paused to reflect that they seemed to be going the opposite way to her. She considered following them for a moment, but pushed on instead, eager to lay eyes on the majesty of the arboreal emperor once again. She found it in a deep valley this time. As before, the immense arch of the upper leaves were a roof to the sky, but where before the lower limbs had also reached up, now a few were bound by golden chains that stretched to the ground, taut and unmoving. Keela's heart skipped a beat at the vision, both awed and concerned. She broke into a run, but no matter how far or fast she tried to approach, the tree remained as distant as ever, out of her reach. She stopped, knowing that she could not come closer by physical effort. This was a place of faith, and through faith she would one day climb amongst those boughs and know the embrace of the heavenly leaves. Chapter 25. Lord of the Huskarls. Breakout. Awaiting army. Lionsgate Spaceport, Mesifex Skin Zone. 15 days since assault. The corridor rang with crashing boots, the whine of servos and undercurrent to the pounding charge of Ran and his Huskarls. Flecks of ceramite splintered from bolt impacts, but they did not slow, even as the intensity of the fire greeting them increased to a storm. Only when they were 30 meters from the Iron Warriors did they lower shields, slowing their pace. Autor was slightly ahead on Ran's right, and checked his stride so that the others came alongside. Ahead, the Sons of Perturabo drew chain blades, while combat attachments on their bolters whirred and gleamed in anticipation of the charge.
"Rampreach!"
Ran called, just 10 meters from the gateway held by the enemy. Seamlessly, the Huskarls maneuvered on the charge. Autor and Ran came together, shields angled to form a point. Their companions fell in beside and behind them, shields braced against their backpacks. As a single blade of powered ceramite, the tip of the Imperial Fist's company hit the Iron Warrior's line. With full power to his legs, Ran drove forward. His axe was in his hand, but he held it back, shield locked to the sergeant's, the triangle of their edges slamming into the breastplate of a 4th Legion warrior, splitting armor like the prow of an ancient galley holding a foe. The wounded Iron Warrior was spun away by the impact, going down to one knee. The Imperial Fist behind Ran, to his left, leapt over the tumbled legionary. The Space Marine behind drove his blade into the enemy's throat, ripping the sword free as the mass of ochre and black plunged onwards. Cut down or hurled back, the Iron Warriors broke apart, allowing the flying wedge to burst through the gateway and onto the broad landing apron beyond. A battle raged across the kilometre-wide span of Ferrocrete, a blur of yellow and black on one side, set against iron and red on the other. In the wake of the Huskarls' attack, 700 more Imperial Fists pounded out into the freezing air, the moisture carried with them crystallizing on their armor as they advanced, their bolter reports sounding stifled in the thin atmosphere. The fire of missiles and laser beams crisscrossed the sky above, from circling gunships and companies ranged across the outskirts of the stories above. Ran urged his warriors onward with raised axe. There was no time to lose. The reinforcements led by Sigismund had drawn much of the ire from the Iron Warriors and their allies. But if Ran's force did not break through to them, they would be driven back from the spaceport. Their mission failed, their losses sustained in vain.
"Over there! That's the one!"
Autor pointed with his sword to the right, into the shadow of a jutting boarding key that ran over the landing pad. A knot of fighters in Iron Warrior's livery hewed their way through a line of yellow. The legionary at their head was a brute of a fighter, clad in old Terminator armor, using his fist like a gleaming hammer. Ran saw an Imperial Fist go down under a series of vicious headbutts, his mask mashed into the flesh and bone of his face, blood splashed across the Iron Warrior's grill.
"Secure the left flank!"
bellowed Ran, even as he altered direction towards the Iron Warrior's champion, breaking the formation. A dozen warriors came with him, Autor included. The others peeled left, bolters and blades directed against a wave of blood-stained world-eaters, pouring along the edge of the landing apron. The Iron Warrior recognized the challenge inherent in Ran's charge, and lifted a gore-spattered fist in reply, taunting the Lord Seneschal. The Imperial Fist could see the rank markings of a warsmith among the blood-spatter and daubed graffiti of defiance.
"Stay close!"
Ran warned his companions, remembering this was a battle, not a dueling cage.
He had no desire to face the Cataphracti alone.
Take down their leader!
Far from waiting to receive the attack, the warsmith leapt forward to meet Rand's charge. Shoulder lowered, arm braced, the iron warrior met the boarding shield at speed. The impact lifted Rand off his feet and sent the warsmith spinning away. Rand crashed to the floor a few meters away, watching his huskarls slamming into the warsmith's guard. The warsmith advanced, fingers of his power fist flexing in anticipation. So much for not being drawn into a duel. His shield bent at almost a right angle, Rand tossed it away and drew his second axe, the heads of both weapons crackling with licks of power. Crouched, legs braced, the Lord Seneschal waited for his opponent to come to him. The Iron Warrior obliged, rushing forward without any attempt to mask his attack, nor to use his combi bolter, fist swinging with sudden speed towards the Seneschal's head. Rand brought up an axe, deflecting the blow to the left, and swung the other upwards, looking for the exposed armpit. The blade caught on chest plate instead, a split second before the warsmith crashed into him, taking them both down with a thunder of breaking armour. Rand rolled, using the last of the Iron Warrior's momentum to push the warsmith away before regaining his feet. The Iron Warrior was slower, but still raised his massively armoured gauntlet in time to meet Rand's next attack. Lightning flared, and the glove burned red in contact, dimming the Seneschal's auto-senses. Quicker than his bulk and armour should have allowed, the warsmith's fist thudded into Rand's gut. It was an odd blow, a brawler's punch rather than a trained space marine's attack, but its power cracked abdominal armour and sent system warnings flaring across Rand's display. He was forced back a step, and in the moment of regaining his balance, realised that momentum had turned against him. The power fist swung for Rand's chest, but caught him on the arm instead, the flare of energy sending splinters of ceramite slashing through the air. There was not a heart's beat of hesitation in the warsmith. He came on without pause, almost crushing Rand's head, clenched fist missing by millimetres to split his pauldron with an impossibly powerful blow. It was more than his Terminator plate that powered such blows, his strength unnaturally boosted. Rand went down on one knee, vision swaying. On instinct, he raised his axes, warding off two more blows to regain his feet. Pride told him he could swing the fight back in his favour. Experience called pride a liar.
"To me!" Rand called. "Huskarls, to me!"
His guards were too embroiled to come to his aid. Rand tried one last time to take the initiative, ducking beneath the blur of the fist, axe angled towards his opponent's thigh. Blade bit into riveted armour, slashed through into flesh. Rand gave a triumphant shout as he dragged the weapon clear, expecting to see a fountain of arterial spurt. Instead, the warsmith backhanded him across the face with his combi bolter, a trickle of thick black fluid leaking from the wound. The power fist caught Rand square in the chest, shattering his plastron, pulverizing the bones within. A sudden loss of breath told him he'd lost at least one lung. Armor warning sigils filled his vision with flashes of red. The warsmith loomed over the Seneschal, lightning-wreathed fist raised for the killing blow. It was impossible to see the warrior's face, but Rand could imagine the gloating eyes, the homicidal grin of a foe that seemed more beast than man. Something black arrived at speed, a gleaming blade flashing out to meet the descending strike. The sword deflected the fist to send it crashing into the ferrocrete just behind Rand's head. Then it spun, catching the side of the Iron Warrior's helm, though it glanced off the angled plate. Blood flowed from a shattered eye lens, bright against the tarnished silver armour. Squinting through swirling pain, Rand saw the knightly helm of his saviour, a second before a wall of yellow crashed around him, the huskarls responding to his call even as the Iron Warriors closed about their own leader. The black-armoured legionary took a step as though to continue the attack, but a blaze of bolter fire from the Iron Warriors dissuaded pursuit. Autor appeared in front of Rand, asking if he was all right. Rand tried to answer but tasted blood bubbling in his mouth. Pain punched up through his ribcage as he tried to stand and he fell back, desperately trying to suck air into damaged lungs.
"Sergeant, get him to safety!"
snarled Sigismund.
"The rest of you, hold ground here."
Lionsgate Spaceport, Tropifex Corps, 15 days since assault. There had been 3 apothecaries in Forex's original force, of which only one had made it to the rendezvous, Umar. Forex had fought alongside him since the Unification Wars, both veterans of the Terran Legion.
Battle cared little for history, but had perhaps a penchant for irony, and so Umar had been one of the first casualties following the muster. A crack missile had opened up his skull as he attended to one of his fellow legionaries. So it was that Forex patrolled the corridors that had become their home, Garal at his side, looking at the wounded, but with no specialist to treat them. Some were so still that it was only the beat of their armor's transponders that betrayed any sign of life. Others moaned and writhed without sedation. Pieces of broken battle plate were piled out of the way, removed to get access to lazwheels, plasma burns, and bolter wounds. Turning down a side passage, Forex came upon a bloody scene, arterial scrawl drying on the wall and ceiling. Two of his warriors were knelt next to a third, holding his plastron onto his chest. Blood foamed around its edges and dribbled from the legionary's mouth. His eyes roamed sightlessly, fixing on the faint lumen hanging from the ceiling. The two iron warriors turned to their superior, one of them delivering a simple prognosis with a shake of the head. Forex stepped over the blood spray, fingers flexing in agitation.
"How many?"
he asked the captain.
"Left,"
replied Garal.
"Yes, left,"
he snapped.
204, including walking wounded. "Nearly 80% casualty rate,"
Forex whispered. Judged against some of the Iron Warrior's past victories, that would count as acceptable. Had Perturabo tasked him with surviving in the midst of enemy territory for so many days with only 1,000 legionaries and no armoured support, he would have thought it impossible.
"Dryok!"
one of the wounded legionaries called out, wheezing breaths, breaking the flow every couple of seconds.
"Help me up! I can still fight!"
Forex looked at the warrior, saw the plasma scarring on his left side.
"You've lost a lung, legionary. That's why they gave us a third."
His bloody grin showed broken remnants of teeth. Forex offered a wrist, then the legionary grabbed it, pulling himself up with a moan. Forex heard air whistling out of the wound in the Space Marine's side. The warsmith stooped and picked up the warrior's bolter, pressing it into his grasp.
"It's Sorovar, isn't it?" "Yes, Dryok. Sergeant." "It will be Lieutenant when we're reunited with the Legion."
Sorovar nodded his thanks, a trembling fist raised to his chestplate in salute.
"See you on the assault line."
He winced with the effort, pain etched into every feature.
"Dryok."
Forex returned the salute and turned away. His pace quickened as resolve hardened in his gut.
"He'll not live out the day,"
Garal said, glancing back at the wounded sergeant.
"Of course not. If we stay here, none of us will."
"I need you to be very clear, Dryok. You want us to move from this position?"
"Only those that can fight," Forex said slowly, fists clenched.
"We're leaving—"
"Keep your voice down."
"We're leaving the wounded, Dryok."
"Yes. We need to jettison the burden."
Forex stopped and rounded on the captain, struggling to keep his voice low.
"We cannot save them, Garal. Either we die with them, or we give ourselves a chance to live."
"And if the enemy take them alive?"
"Let them. What are they going to reveal? That we came in here without a specific objective? That we only have 200 fighters left? None of this will be news to our enemies."
Forex rubbed a knuckle across an itch on his forehead, smearing soot and blood over skin cracking from dehydration.
"There is a tiny chance that our foes might even treat them. There's not much honor left in this war, and I know the Fourth had little enough to begin with."
"We could finish them ourselves,"
Garal suggested quietly, hand tapping the side of his bolter.
"We haven't got the ammunition,"
Forex told him with a frown. The warsmith stepped back and waved towards a pair of legionaries slumped against the wall nearby.
"And do you really want to take your blade to their throats?"
Garal's helm turned as his gaze moved between the Triarch and the injured, back and forth deliberating. Forex would have told Garal it was a command, that his opinion mattered nothing, but the warsmith was living off borrowed authority. If Garal, or one of the two surviving lieutenants, decided to lead a mutiny, there was a good chance Forex would get a bolt in the back of the head.
"I'm thinking about those of us that have a chance," said Forex, grabbing the captain's arm. "We need to break through to the outer levels. There's a monorail terminal 1 kilometer north of here. We'll move fast, head down the track to a skybridge."
towards the Imperial Palace, Trihug.
Better than deeper into the spaceport.
Forex cocked his head and raised a finger, indicating for Garal to listen. The distant pound of explosions had become nothing but background noise.
The barrage continues. Lion's Gate spaceport is still contested. If we can get to the outer levels, we might be able to contact Legion Command.
Fast. Precise. We can do this. Garal pulled free his arm and offered his hand for Forex to grip. The warsmith did so, wrist to wrist in Olympian custom.
We will live, so that we can remember the fallen.
Himalaya, undisclosed location, 28 days before assault. The valley opened out, stretching a dozen kilometers from side to side. The mountainsides around it were artificially hewn, a semicircle of laser-cut cliffs that soared hundreds of meters above the mustering site. Zenobi had a perfect view perched alongside the battle cannon of Breath of Wrath, able to see down the road as it dipped below two bastions built out from the slopes themselves. Gun turrets as big as the tank festooned each pillar tower, tracking the incoming column with macro cannons and immense laser batteries. Overhead the sky was black and grey, swathed with smog from the bombardment. Nothing could be seen of the fluctuating aegis of the palace itself, 100 kilometers beyond the far wall. Even more incredible was the sea of machines and people that thronged the artificial caldera. Squadrons of walkers, batteries of self-propelled guns and artillery were spread out along a grid of roads stretching from the main highway, as well as companies of mechanized infantry with troop carriers.
How?
Zenobi looked up again, seeing just the faintest shimmer of an energy field distorting the dark clouds and streaming embers. A faint drizzle of rain misted the air. Debris was still falling from orbit weeks after the void battle had ended, streaking the fumes with false meteors.
It's a special type of void shield, called a reflex shield, said Nasha.
He shrugged.
They briefed us before we left, but I'm not sure how it works. All I remember is that it's keeping the muster base hidden from scans. Even light doesn't escape. One of the traitor's aircraft could be right overhead, and they'd just see a haze of rock.
But there's so many troops here, said Zenobi. Why aren't they fighting?
Some plan of Dawn's, I'd say. A reserve force?
The column continued on. It was joined a few minutes later by a score of provosts on motorcycles, the flashing beacon lights of their steeds guiding the tanks to their allotted encampment. The roadway was raised here, giving them a view across the crater. Nasha pointed out various companies and regiments as they passed.
Over there!
He said excitedly, pointing to a company of building-sized tanks in black and red livery, stark among the camouflage of the surrounding regiments.
Anzac Heavy Brigade! Those are the very same Baneblades that broke the noose of Kabbalah!
How do you know this?
Zenobi laughed to see him so enthused, like a child allowed free rein with another's toys.
We have our own claim to the Old Hundred. The Golden Hegere came from Bak Makka. Well, the old precincts that were there before it. My ancestors have been fighting for the Emperor since the earliest days of the Unification Wars.
And now you're following that proud tradition, she said.
Maybe not my ancestors. I'm not from any of the heralded bloodlines. My family are algae farmers, mostly. A few made it onto the local council, but that's it. If not for the Warmaster, I'd be slopping wet mush from evaporators instead of commanding this magnificent metal creature.
They came to a halt about 2 kilometers from the entrance, squadrons of tanks peeling to left and right. At shouts from their officers, the Adaba Free Corps spilled from the backs of the parking vehicles, like a metal snake shedding its skin from nose to tail.
I need to be get...
Nasha grabbed her arm and pulled her close, his lips finding hers a heartbeat later. Tears welled up as she tasted him, wondering if it would be the last time. Eventually they parted.
Red border, gold braiding, green pennant,
he told her, nodding to the banner flying from a pole at the back of the turret. She gave him a quizzical look.
There's a lot of tanks here, but only my one has that flag.
Red border, gold braiding, green pennant,
she repeated, fixing the sight of it in her memory.
I don't know where we'll be. If you don't find me, I'll find... No, don't do that,
Zenobi said sharply, causing him to flinch. She softened, stroking fingers down the lapel of his tanker's jacket.
We have security officers that would punish us both if you were found.
So, this is it?
Maybe not. I'll find you if I can.
She kissed him again, gently, lingering in the moment of connection. It took more effort to drag herself away from his embrace than it had to forge through the blizzards. Zenobi mustered the strength to do so, turning away. She picked up her kit bag and tossed it down to where Member was waiting beside the tank. She handed him the standard pole next, and then followed, her lasgun slung over her back by its strap.
"Saying farewell, cousin,"
he said, the expression stern. Everybody else had moved away, leaving just the two of them.
"You know nothing can come of it."
"Something already has,"
she said with a smile.
"Say nothing to the integrity officers. If they question your loyalty for an instant..."
"I'll be careful, cousin. I promise."
Lionsgate Spaceport, Tropifex Mantle Zone, 16 days since assault. There were breakthroughs all across the boundary levels between the Starspear and Sky City. Sigismund did the best he could to shore up the weakening defence, but he leaned heavily on Lieutenant Commander Hager to see through the implementation. Remembering the words of Keeler, the Templar put himself in the forefront of every counterattack, and for two solid days had fought as though he could single-handedly drive back the Iron Warriors and their twisted allies.
"First Captain, new report from the Corps patrols."
Hager had timed his vox call to coincide with Sigismund's transit from one embattled area to the next, a window of a few minutes' relative peace.
"Captain Thunderman requests reinforcement or withdrawal orders. We're experiencing augury blackout on the orbital scans. Lord Dawn has sent instruction that we hold for another 18 hours.
Boarding the rhino that would take him across the level to the conveyor station around the besieged sky bridges, Sigismund considered each of these in turn.
"Tell Thunderman to pull back to the second cordon. There is no gain in getting trapped between the two advancing forces. The augurs are in the purview of the tech priests. We can do nothing except stand ready for the enemy to receive more troops from orbit. As for the third, I plan to hold as long as possible." "Did Lord Dawn indicate what would happen after 18 hours?" "He said there would be further assistance, but did not care to share the details." "Transmit to Legion Command that we will hold the Lionsgate spaceport for as long as the Lord Praetorian wills it so."
Sigismund spared a moment to check the Rhino's progress on the telemetric display.
"We shall be at the gate Stratos 14 Delta in 2 minutes. Have the companies on levels 708 through 713 push to my position for counterattack."
"Affirmative, First Captain."
There was a pause of several seconds, but the link did not cut.
"I've heard that a new enemy strike force has been assembled and is cutting through our defences more swiftly than we can recover." "Is that a report, Hager?" "More of a rumour. But there is scattered vox traffic that claims sightings of Sons of Horus led by Ezekiel Abaddon himself. We are losing contact with anyone that they come upon."
A shudder of apprehension and excitement coursed through Sigismund. This was the words of Keeler made clear, his purpose suddenly revealed.
"Where was this last rumour, Hager? If I extrapolate, I would say that the enemy strike force is heading for level 902, somewhere near Beta Quadrant."
"Redirect all commands in the bridge sector to my direct authority. Full assault preparation."
"What of Lord Dawn's command to hold?"
"If we do not parry this strike before it lands, there will be no point holding."
His fingers moved to the runes of the terminal, keying in commands to locate the shortest route to Beta Quadrant of Sky City. Visions flashed through Sigismund's thoughts, of himself with blade in hand, standing against the Lord of the Mournival. Surely if Abaddon fell beneath the blade of the Templar, it would be a great victory for the servants of the Emperor. Chapter 26 Intrusions. The Half-Born. Dangerous Relations. Europa War Zone, 16 days since assault. Some would have called it luck, others destiny. Amon suspected Keeler would attribute his timely arrival to the will of the Emperor. As far as he was concerned, it was nothing of these, simply the inevitable result of diligence and logic, coupled with a preemptive attitude. He was swiftly becoming more absorbed in the nature of the Lectitio Divinitatis, day by day getting more acquainted with their customs, personnel, and movements. What had seemed a disorganized clutter on the surface
belied a sophisticated organic communications network on par with the most complex espionage cell systems he had encountered. But it was all the more remarkable because there was no nefarious puppet master at the centre, nor were the vast majority of those participating in the movement even aware of the greater part of the whole. By ways and means, originating in necessity, the faithful had discovered how to identify each other without direct contact, centering themselves around commonly regarded symbols, phrases, and mannerisms, without ever directly communicating them. It was like a virus, passed on by contact, embodied in the sermons that were delivered, the pamphlets handed out, the pages of the Lectitio Divinitatis itself. The similarity to the spread of a disease was not lost on Amon, and he had coined a term for it, the plague of belief. It was, he was sure, as potentially threatening as any physical malaise, being a corruption of culture that undermined the tenets of the Emperor's vision for humanity. As soon as he had considered the spread of faith as an epidemiological issue, he had found tracing it from one place to another far more straightforward. Though he had begun with plague victims and Medicaid facilities, the premise had led him farther afield, beyond the Sanctum Imperialis, to the ultimate wall itself. And in doing so, he had noticed a pattern, or rather, a void in a pattern. Despite the clandestine support of a handful of higher-ranking Imperial Army officers, the worship of the Emperor was still forbidden among the ranks of the troopers. As such, soldiers were forced to gather off-duty, or to make time and space within their duties when not directly engaged. Opportunities for either were exceedingly rare, with the enemy at the walls themselves. A break in vox chatter, uncovered by Amon, had piqued his interest. A patrol that had made excuses for a late return, whose sergeant had been absent or delayed on other occasions. He might have ignored it, but their proximity to the garrisoned quarantine zone, where the matter had been brought to light, demanded further investigation. He came upon the bodies in a disused way station, about a kilometre and a half inside the curtain wall, just within the perimeter of the Palatine Arc quarantine zone. The detritus scattered about the bare chamber had all the markings of an impromptu fane, including a bloodied copy of the Lectitio Divinitatis. It seemed likely that others from the garrison had performed a rite in this place. The corpses had been torn open, rib cages splayed from the inside, skin and flesh hanging in tatters from broken bones. Amon had not seen the like. It was as though the killer had emptied the victims of their insides. Each had been hollowed out, the tattered edges of ribs and breastbones showing striations like gnaw marks. How all 10 of them had succumbed was another mystery, for each lay in close proximity, and though their weapons were close at hand, not one of them had fingers on a gun or pistol grip. Whatever had overcome them had done so with instant and brutal swiftness. The floor was muddy, tracked by boot marks in and out, but among the blood spatter were other footprints. They appeared barefoot, with long nails, some with 3 toes, others 4 or 5. It was impossible to tell how many assailants, but at least 4, and quite likely more. The stench was far worse than simple dead flesh and evacuated bowels. Amon knew the smell of death, and this was edged with an acidic tang. In total contradiction, he thought he also detected a floral scent, and on closer inspection of the corpses, could not find any soap or other perfume that would explain its lingering presence. He voxed the closest Legio Custodes outpost on the outer barbican of the main Sanctum Imperialis, almost 90 kilometres away.
"Argent Tower, this is Custodian Amon. I am pursuing a possible incursion force into the Palatine Arc, heading northeast through the quarantine zone. Urgent dispatch of support required."
His vox buzzed for several seconds. Before a reply was forthcoming, a shadow on the wall warned him of movement behind. He was fully armoured, his guardian spear in hand, a lesson he had learned at the hospital. Amon was turning, the blade blurring with its energy field, even before he registered the nature of his attackers. The tip scored a line across the chest of the first, bubbling ichor spilling forth in its wake. The creature that flopped back reminded him of the Neverborn he had seen in the webway, supposedly incarnations of the plague power. The others, 9 more, closed fast with clawed hands, their limbs famine-thin, bellies swollen like old corpses. But there the similarity ended. These fiends looked more human in feature, with a pair of eyes rather than one, lank hair hanging from scalps, and on three of them, cheeks and chin. Their flesh was a mottle of pinkish-white and dark brown, and their eyes were startlingly human. As he slashed his spear tip through the throat of another, his thoughts sprang back to the mutilated bodies of the patrol, and the origins of these half-demon hybrids became obvious. The thought sickened him, even though he had seen sights that would have driven lesser warriors to madness, that somehow these creatures had emerged or incubated themselves within the bodies of the troopers. He did not pause in his assault, not allowing his enemies any advantage from their ambush. His spear's bolter roared, hard and bright in the confines of the chamber, the salvo cutting down two more of the demon kin. One thing was for certain. These were no ghostly manifestations, drawn of warp power and nothing more. They died as easily as mortals, perhaps shorn of true demonic resilience by their hybrid birth and the shield of the Emperor. Some tried to flee, which was also a first for Amon. In his experience, the Neverborn were near mindless in their assaults, uncaring of personal danger or tactical disadvantage. They survived only by the whim of the power that created them. But these half-born knew fear. He saw dread in their eyes as he cut them down, his armor bathed in sickly gore. Four eluded his immediate ire, disappearing into the adjoining hallway. He gave chase, guardian spear roaring more bolts after them.